how's it going?
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's going very good. I'm working on, it's out and about now that I'm on this Apollo 11 tribute Project Egress. And Bob, I think you are too. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many makers are involved. Is there
There's a lot.
15, maybe 20?
Probably closer to 20. I saw the list. It's a lot of people.
And each one of us was asked, invited to make a part of this door. I think it's only the door, right? It's just the door of the Apollo 11 because it's the 50th anniversary.
Yeah, it's the hatch. Yeah, and all the mechanism that's on the backside of the hatch, which is pretty crazy.
A lot. So I'm making two of those hinges. So I 3D printed them 2 weeks ago. That was what I was 3D printing all about. And now I'm replicating them out of eBay hardwood, and so I'm pretty far through it. It's so that's what I've been working on all weekend. Plus, I had to make two Seagram 7 signs, and I had to crate them and everything. So, I've been busy since the welding class ended. Since basically we spoke last week, I've been just jamming every single day to get all these different projects done, or all aspects of these two projects done. And I still have a lot to do on the hinges, but I'm in a pretty good place and a really good direction. So it's been fun figuring it out. Having to make things twice. And so I 3D printed them, and now I'm making them, replicating them by hand with bandsaws and sanders and files and drill presses.
Does that mean you'll discard the 3D printed ones and send in the wood ones?
Yeah. Yeah. The wood ones are going to be the final part. Because at this point, the 3D model ones are pretty beat up.
Mm.
From, you know,
it was pretty cool watching your story and seeing like the pieces next to the 3D printed one. And I mean, there's a lot of detail in the shape, like, and these pieces,
yeah.
Part of the deal was these pieces have to be exact. They have to be, you know, really, well machined, well made so that they fit together. Because I just looked it up. There's 43 different makers who are making parts.
Whoa.
And all these parts have to fit together. And it's a lot of really complex mechanism to make it happen. So anyway, it's cool to see your wooden pieces next to the 3D printed ones. And they're like,
yeah.
All those little intricate shapes are there. It's pretty awesome.
Thank you. Yeah, it's difficult trying to figure out. But one thing that's really interesting is as I'm working my way through it, they look like they're just random. They're obviously made out of a block. So when they were made 50 years ago, somebody decided to machine them, and they were obviously designed in a certain way too. So they were designed to be machined fairly simple. And I made these wooden blocks that encompass the volume of the shape. And as I'm going into it, I'm realizing, oh, that right angle helps me cut this right angle, and that helps me cut that. And I'm starting to realize that whoever designed them in a way that there's a lot of right angles. And even though it looks complicated and there's compound curves and compound angles, I should say, there's not too many curves, but there's a lot of compound angles. It with just a little bit of jigging and rigging, I'm able to get 90 degrees so I could pass everything through the bandsaw blade at the proper angle. So it's I can kind of, after working them physically by hand, I could see the reasoning and the development of the person who designed it in the piece. That makes sense.
It is kind of interesting. These pieces are like, you know, we're making individual pieces that have to fit together into a small assembly. Like I'm doing a little assembly. We are. You're doing different assembly. And then those assemblies have to fit together. But we don't really have the context as to like what the part does or what it. And it's kind of weird because I think we're all used to making a full project start to finish, or at least I am anyway. You know, you make the whole thing with the intention, like you know what it's going to do. And so you build the piece to fit the end goal. And this is just building a piece to fit another piece, really. It's just kind of weird. I don't know.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, to be honest, when Jen Schechter asked me if I wanted to be involved, I said, yeah, of course. And why would I say no? I said, absolutely. And she's like, all right, I'm going to send over the drawings of what we need for you to make. I opened up the PDF and I was like, oh my God, why did I say yes to this? I looked at this set of drawings and I was just like, my first reaction was, what have I gotten myself into? Because it's totally the opposite of free form. It's the opposite of bandsaw. It's the opposite of everything. So I panicked for a second and then I was like, okay, this is that moment in time where you get challenged and you have to live up to the challenge. Mm-hmm. These are those moments where, you know, they say like, you know, when you have some stress in your life, they say, you know, you're being tested, you know, God or whatever is testing you. This is like the maker gods were testing me. They're like, oh yeah, you think you know how to make stuff? Make this. And they threw this on my lap. And, you know, now it's like everybody in the world wants to know if I ever met Adam Savage. I still haven't met Adam Savage and I don't know him. I'm involved in this through his assistants, but I'm like, oh God, if I'm going to fall on my face, I don't want it to be with something that I'm associated with Adam for. And, you know, of all things, I want it to be something that's a success, or at least a successful make attempt. So I took a close look at it and I was like, okay, these are just parts and shape. These are just parts and shapes and space. I just have to chip away the negative space up to the line that they've created in space. This is just arbitrary randomness. And I just have to just duplicate the arbitrary randomness that's on that piece of paper. And that's how I abstract it from my brain. Because otherwise, if I look at exactly what it is, I say, oh, I can't do this. But then I thought for a minute, I'm like, oh, they must have files because these drawings are so beautiful. So, okay, yeah, they have the fusion models, send over the fusion models. I 3D print them. And then if I have the object, I know if the object is in physical space, I know I can make at least 95% accurate copy of it using my hand tools and files and all these things.
I wonder what the backup plan is. There's 40-some people making different pieces of the puzzle. Like, not all pieces are going to fit. There's going to be...
There's got to be. I was thinking that last night. Yeah. There's got to be. And at the end of the day, the thing is just a collage of objects. It doesn't have to go on a capsule, and it's not going to need to be airtight, and it's not going to get shot into space. It's an art piece. It's a collective art piece. It's basically looking at the hatch and saying, what a feat of engineering. Let's let all these people participate and duplicate that in honor of the original engineers that designed this.
I did think about that as well, though. Like, what if one of us tries to make these pieces and we can't, or, you know, something breaks or something doesn't fit together? Like, they have to, I would assume, they have to have backups of the entire build ready to fill in the gaps in case, you know, somebody can't come through. Or I wondered about that as well, because I mean, the way we're doing our parts is we got a resin printer, an SLA printer, and so we are printing out all the individual pieces, which there was some learning curve to that, to getting the pieces printed at that, in that type, and then we're molding and casting them. So my idea was to mold and cast them out of, because it's a small assembly that'll fit in your palm of your hand, but there's like 9 separate pieces, I think. And so I wanted to cast them in different color translucent resin so that when you look at the assembly, you can see all the individual pieces, you know, even though they're attached with pins and they kind of run through each other and stuff, you could glance at it and see all the different things, and it would kind of look like it was made out of like gummy bears or something, that type of look. And so it's been interesting. I mean, I've done molding and casting before. I've done SLA printing before, but we got this new printer and then we used new resin and new silicone. And so there's been a whole bunch of learning that's gone into this. Josh has been doing a whole bunch of it on his own to prep parts. And then we've been doing the molding and casting together. And so, you know, we've learned a whole lot of stuff, and I decided along the way not to make any content out of it, really. No video or anything, because it's just so much trial and error. So like, well, you know, let's try this molding. That mold didn't work. So that wasted a day of an attempt, you know, to like mold and the cast this thing. It's got a bubble in it, so we got to start over on that piece. And so, but I mean, we're ending up with the pieces the way that I want them, but it's been interesting, because it's, even though the pieces are for something external to us, most of the work and most of the learning is just going to stay internal, because, you know, we'll wrap that knowledge into something else in the future, but it's really just been a lot of learning within
molding something in clear is very, very, very complicated. It seems simple when you get a nice, beautiful, clear part, but getting there is so hard.
Yeah. And these pieces are not simple. So getting molds of a crazy bracket that has a bunch of through holes in it, so you have like these silicon pieces that run through where there's supposed to be a pin or a dowel or a screw or something, and there's multiples of those on a single piece going on different directions. So when you take it out of the mold, you're having to cut these silicone through pins, hoping that they'll go back together enough when you pour to cast them so that there is a negative space, you know. So there's a bunch of that type of stuff to work
with.
We've learned a lot.
A way to solve, I don't know how complicated your part is, and it's obviously not extremely important because it's not going in space, but if you have a part and you want to make a mold of it and it has a through hole in it, and that through hole, you know, you're depending upon like a dangly piece of rubber in the mold. Typically what some people will do is they might put a brass pin in the actual part, mold it with that brass pin in it, then take it apart, pull the breast pin out of the first part, stick it back in the mold, because you'll have the two little negative caps on either side of the hole. So then when you take your finished part out, you just pop that brass pin out. You have a perfect hole. So
we kind of talked about something like that. And I, at some point in the conversation, I decided in my head that that wouldn't work. And now that you're saying it, I realize it was because I didn't leave room for that pin to extend past.
Yeah, no, it needs to go into the mold. Yeah, it has to stick.
I was thinking of the pin as like the actual pin that would go there, but it has to go past that. It has to be able to go into the mold. Huh.
Yeah.
Cool. Learn something new.
Yeah. Yeah. And then if it's like shallow, like I'm doing a hinge plate. So if it's a shallow plate, it's really not that important. But it's when you have a long hole through that you have to worry about. Because those little danglers will certainly not
line up. We left kind of like a... So I cut off one of these through-hole pieces, but left little tabs, right? And so that molded one. So you have like a little inset on both sides with the intent of drilling through one to the other. But if you don't get it perfectly square and perfectly centered, you don't hit the other side of the through-hole. And so we've had a few pieces like that where it's just like, we get to that point, I drill the hole, and I'm like, nah, it's not quite right. We got to start over on that piece.
I came to the conclusion to do mine. Actually, it was Kevin Lazat was here when I was 3D printing it. So we were discussing it. I wanted his help, and he was going to come. He still might come. We still have some time. But it was his idea. He said, why don't you make it look kind of like old-timey and use some like beautiful hardwood. And the minute he said it, I'm like, oh, I know exactly what I have. I have these cutoffs from the boardwalk in Long Island. When they rebuilt the boardwalk after Hurricane Sandy, my buddy brought me a whole bunch of these extra cutoffs. So it's this really hard wood. It must be Ipe, I think it is. And so I made it all out of that. And then Kevin was going to, I'm not sure if there's time for him to get here or not, but he definitely helped in the conceptualizing of the finished parts. I'm going to make the flat parts out of brass and all the pins out of brass to hold it all together. So that's something I'm going to be doing.
Cool. It'll be really interesting to see how this whole thing comes together and see how many different things are being, different, you know, processes and materials are being used. I have a feeling there'll be a lot of 3D printed parts because of the complexity of the parts. I think a lot of people will 3D print them and then do an interesting finishing technique on them, which is, that's fine. But,
I want to apologize to Joel Telling, because the other day when I was showing it on my Instagram, so I was like, 3D printing's boring, it's gross, so I'm going to make them out of wood. And he goes, hey, man, that's what I do. I'm like, no. And I sent him a message, but I'm going to say this publicly to anybody else that might have been offended. I love 3D printing. I think it's absolutely amazing. It's just anytime I show it in a video, it just doesn't get me any points. So that's why I had to resort to, if it wasn't for 3D printing, I wouldn't have been able to get to where I was. I would have just been looking at drawings and complicating the process of trying to make them completely in space by myself. So with the 3D printing, I was able to get to where I was. So I didn't mean it the way it sounded. I love 3D printing. And for me, it's amazing, because when I got this assignment and I looked at the pictures and then I asked Jen for the 3D files and then I opened the files, I was like, okay, now I got a 3D printer. I have to turn that 3D printer on. I haven't turned on in 4 months, and I got another brand new one in the box from Naomi Wu from Shenzhen. So I got to open that up. And within 20 minutes, they were both printing. So I got right back into it. I always get this fear of losing the tech. I'm always afraid I'm going to get into something, I'm going to learn all this complicated stuff, and then I'm going to lose that technology because I don't practice it. But with the two 3D printers, I was like, okay, here we go. It goes a whole ball of learning curve that I completely forgot in the last 3 or 4 months. But I jumped right back into it, and it was not a problem at all.
So you get that confidence back for it quickly?
Yeah.
Cool. That's awesome.
Well, the first the first part I started to print, is it nearby? Oh, yeah, look. So this is the first part I printed. It didn't come out great.
Oh, look at that. It
didn't come out great.
Yeah.
It looks like a clown's wig, basically.
It does.
That's
crazy looking.
This is 5 hours of extrusion, not sticking to anything. 5 hours. The average print was 10 hours on these parts. And that, I went to sleep starting that, and it had a good base, and I woke up. I heard it in the other room, because it was near my bedroom, and I heard it going, G-G-G-G-G-G-G. So I listened to the sound, and I woke up to the sound. I'm like, oh, cool. It didn't fail in the middle of the night. I went in the room. I was like, I just printed a clown wig.
It has been my experience that 3D printers don't work when you're sleeping. Don't know what it is, but they don't work when you're sleeping. You have to watch.
That's true, because I started all the other prints early in the morning and just kept coming in, like as I walk the dogs and check on the animals. I'm like, okay, it's still good. It's still good. 8 hours later, oh, good, it's still good. And then the one of the last prints I made was on the new CR10, the Creality 10, and it comes with like a test roll of PLA. Is it PLA? It comes with the test roll. And so I just started I did the cat and I did the lion. And then I was like, I just printed those two things, which used up 10, 15% of the wire. And then I printed the part I needed and it like got down with like 10 inch piece left. So all day long, I'm like, oh my God, I hope I have enough to print. Cause I don't even have any more. I don't even have anything. Cause the other printer was going with a big spool on it. But anyway,
the Ultimaker has a cool feature. It's got a camera built into it and you can actually look at it through your phone if you're on the same Wi-Fi network to see if everything is going as planned.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah, it is pretty handy. When I first got that printer, I looked at it a lot when I was printing things on it.
Yeah.
And then it just kind of kept working, so I stopped having to look at them. It does a pretty good job. Well, David, what have you been up to?
A few days ago, I put out the drill press lift, and it works, just not as good as expected. So we're gonna do some changes. We have a...
I like that video, by the way.
Thank you.
It was cool.
Great video.
And
great idea.
Speaking of 3D printing, it's got 3D printing, laser, and CNC all in one video.
I like how you just dove into that. You were like, well, we've already used these two, so what the heck?
So we used a drill and a PWM and a laptop charger to wire everything up. And it works great, but I think one of the issues we have is there's this little flex arm, so we could have the controls out front, and this little drill flex arm wraps around the corner onto the drill, and it loses some torque, and it just doesn't go down very smooth. And so it works, and it works for the video, but it just didn't have that. It wasn't satisfying. And so we found another motor that's on just something on Amazon. And we found one that has the RPMs that we're looking for. So we can totally get rid of the potentiometer and remove the speed. And this one, we're going to, I made a coupling to go over the 3/8 part and the half inch part. And it's just going to be mounted directly on the shaft. And it's just going to be, and then somebody in the comments has a really good suggestion of, instead of just doing the three-way switch, you want a momentary switch. So you can just go up and let go, and then it stops. And so we're actually going to do all those modifications. And yeah, so thank goodness for the comments, because there's so many good suggestions in there. I'm not going to do a video on it, at least not on my main channel, of the upgrades. Maybe I'll throw on a Patreon or my second channel. But yeah. I'm really happy. It looks really cool. I'm really happy with the way it looks. So, and then this week we're working on the Nintendo build, and I'm going to go pick up supplies for it as soon as we're done with this. I'm going to try. I have two designs, and the plan is to actually complete both designs. If I only get one, that'd be fine. But one of the designs is using bent plywood, where you cut the grooves into it and then you can bend it into the shape that you want.
Oh, yeah. I've always wanted to try that.
I've never done it, so I'm going to practice on it today. And then if the tests go well, we'll execute that tomorrow. One of the issues that I'm having with the design is currently the cartridge goes in at an angle and then pushes down. I want to get rid of that. There's a 72-pin connector in there, and I want to modify that. And I bought a spare one in case I modify it in a way that I can't go back or it doesn't work.
Kills it.
Kills it, yeah. So there's I'm going into it with 60% of it planned, and then there's the 40% has to be, the decision will be made on spot. And that kind of worries me, because I can't completely picture how it's going to look. And so the thing that worries me is, like, is it going to be as cool as I want it to be? So we'll see. But it'll be fun. It'll definitely be fun.
Hmm. So I guess you did go back and test the electronics after you pulled them out and made sure everything worked?
I did. Right after last week's podcast, I pulled the electronics and plugged it into the TV, and it worked just fine. So
nice.
I also bought, there's clone NESs out there. and they're super cheap. And so I bought one for $20. And so I want, the reason I want to do two of them is I want to say, if you don't have an NES or you don't want to destroy one, you can buy one of these clones and use that for $25 and then make your own enclosure. And the board for the clone is tiny. Like it's,
yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's way different than it was 40 years ago. So,
That's cool. I'm looking forward to seeing that. You, when you showed the Nintendo in the drill press video, like in the background, I don't remember. I think we were watching it here in the office, and somebody said, like, "Oh, he's going to get attacked for that," because you were like holding it up and like, "I ripped this apart." You know? And people that love vintage technology are going to be like, "Why would you tear that apart?" And blah 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 blah. But it looked like the one that you used was in pretty bad shape on the outside.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. It really ugly. It's very discolored. There's stickers on it. Yeah. No. I don't think...
You may want to show that because you're going to get... I mean, I know you like that kind of like back and forth stuff, but you may want to show that and be like, look how disgusting this is. We're going to make it better.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm also thinking about experimenting of maybe this is one of my non-talking videos and we just kind of shoot it and you're just going to kind of see the progress. And then maybe we'll talk at the end of the video and kind of recap everything. I might experiment with the style of video this time.
That's cool. Speaking of, Jimmy, you've been releasing some of your older videos.
Lately. Oh, yeah. I signed What's on with... the... when I was out in L.A., I signed on with a Ben Pixels. It's like a... It's a... It's not exactly a network. They are a network, but they saw all this content I had. They're part of my agency, so... And it's like not a long-term commitment. Anyway, so I always tough talk being involved in a network, but I got involved with these guys because they had a pretty decent contract. And anyway, they saw all this extra content I had everywhere else that wasn't on my channel. And it was their idea. They said, you have all this content all around the world. How do you get it on your channel? And I said, well, people always call this stuff classic, the rest of these old videos. And we brainstormed with this happened when I was in LA doing the TV show. And they brainstormed up this idea with me and said, why don't you just put it out every Thursday called Throwback Thursday? This way, eventually all the content will be on your channel, garnishing you the views. Because some of these videos are on Make Channel and Rockler and Core 77. Some of them have millions of views and none of those views are on my channel. And I just put a video out the other day and it's, you know, it's at 170,000 views for something that I assumed everybody saw 50 times. But... you know, the one thing we got to remember is that there's so many random people watching our channels. It's not necessarily the people that are subscribed to us either. I don't know what kind of rate either of you have, but like when I look at my analytics and I see the amount of people that watch my videos, like a very small percentage of the people that are actually subscribed to me. The huge percentage is people that just found my content. So I'm getting a really good reaction to it, and they're very happy. The guys over it. At Ben Pixels, they're really happy with the concept, and you know, I'm just surprised that people are viewing as much as they are. So I have probably 90 videos or 100 videos that aren't on my channel that are everywhere else.
That's a couple of years worth of content that you'll put up. The cool thing about what you do is you develop your style like super early on, and so when you throw in these older videos, they fit right in. Like
it's true.
your videos are better now as it naturally progresses, but they still fit right in to your content. If you took one of my videos from 3 years ago and shoved it in there, people would be like, what the crap am I watching?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, it's great. It's awesome. And I guess I'm going to try and do it every Thursday so that the people that have already seen these things, you know, I've been accused of being lazy. Oh my God, this is just lazy content. I can't.
You are one of the laziest people I know, Jimmy Duresta.
Yeah. And so I called somebody on. I'm like, I'm not being lazy. I said, I have all this content. Like, you know, put yourself in my shoes. You have all this content that's not on your channels. And always the original agreement with all these people always was, okay, you'll run it for a year and then I put it on my channel.
That's
and
very
I used
smart,
to do that a
way.
Little bit. I used to do that. Thank you. I used to do that a little bit here and there, but, you know, I'd call it, you know, re-upload. But now that it's got a framework and it's got like a schedule, it just seems a little bit more scheduled, a little better, so to speak. So
that's cool. So, well, for me, we put out the other part of our treehouse video last week, and I don't want to get into this. The three of us talked to it a little bit about this a little bit before we recorded, but the comments have been, you know, comments
great and encouraging and lovely.
No, not so much. It's interesting though, because I noticed that, you know, a lot of times YouTube comments are one thing and they have a stigma around them, and it's there. Like, you see the negative stuff or whatever. For me, the other platforms are not usually like that, because my following on other platforms is so much smaller than on YouTube that it's, you know, it's generally positive and everything. And in the last couple of days, Twitter has taken on the same tone of the kind of weird, aggressive, negative thing. And it's weird. I'm just not used to it. But anyway, that stuff has been my last several days, and we'll move on.
I just want to say, it looks super awesome. The lights on the top just like set it off. I'm like, that just, it looks super classy. It looks like it belongs there, and it's really cool. And I wish I had something like that when I was a kid. So,
well, thanks.
Yeah, your family's very lucky.
My kids love it, and they're having fun with it, and they are more than safe in it. So,
yeah.
We'll leave. Has that been the big complaint that they're not safe?
That's. Yeah. Everybody knows more about safety than everybody else, apparently. So,
yeah.
But Bob, like I said, I'm going to give you a little encouragement, Bob. Your numbers are incredible. Your videos are incredible, and you're doing so well. So, just look back and look at what you've created. Look at the body of work you've created, the team you've created, the inspiration you're creating. Just got to remember that.
And I do remember those things. I appreciate that, and I'm not wallowing in anything. But it's, you know. Negative stuff is negative, whether it affects you or not, it's still negative. But I was talking to somebody because of this the last couple of days, and they brought up a really good point that all of us get into this line of work or this, whatever this thing is that we're doing, as a single person. You know, we come into it and we want to create a thing, we put it out in the world, and you are one person that takes a certain amount of input and output. And as your channel grows, as the people that watch you and are looking at you grow, that input becomes greater. Your output eventually has to become greater, and sometimes you make more videos, sometimes you hire people. The output has to grow somewhat, excuse me, probably at a very different rate than what the input's growing. But eventually, those two numbers get further and further from each other, so that your input, the comments, positive, negative, likes, all that stuff, becomes exponentially larger than what you can output. And so you are getting all sorts of input. And sometimes that can be so positive in a way that it's like a feedback loop that makes you think you're the best thing in the world. And, you know, sometimes it's so negative that it makes you think you're the worst thing in the world. But it all comes down to, you are still the same size target, and you are getting more arrows shot at you. And I think that's more than somebody saying something negative. I think that's the thing that I've kind of realized, is that I'm still the same person. And granted, there's other people that work here. They have a stake in this. They have, you know, they are affected by the input as well. So I'm not just saying it's all on me, but I'm still the face. I'm still a single person who, whereas a couple of years ago, would take hundreds of comments. Now I get thousands of comments. And even if the ratio of positive and negative is the same percentage, you're going from like 5, 10 negative comments to 50, 100 negative comments. You know, I mean, there's these numbers are growing. I'm not, right? Yeah. I'm still one target. And I don't mean that target like everybody's out to get me, but like the stuff is aimed at someone, positive or negative. And so I guess I only bring that up because it was kind of a realization that, like, when we, any of us, leave feedback on any creation that any other human has put out into the world, it really would do everyone well to understand the amount of pylon that you are being a part of. If you're being part of the positive pylon for that person, you know, of all the comments and everything, awesome. You are doing your best to build that person up. If you are being part of the negative pylon, just realize that it's, it grows exponentially, and people can only take so much negative input before it really starts to affect them. And I'm not saying that from like a, oh, poor me.
Yeah.
I'm just, it was a realization about the state of social media
things. Unfortunately, it's the culture. I never left a negative comment on anything in my life. Only if anything, if anybody finds anything negative, I may have said it's only been a reaction to somebody else. And I learned a long time ago to just not, most of them I delete. If I could look at it and think of something funny to retort, I'll do that. And sometimes I've said this before, I just say something super nasty. I hit upload and then I delete it because it goes to the email anyway. So they'll see the reaction and then it's not public and then I block them and then they can't fight back. So
I know
that's the way to do it.
Yeah, I know you didn't want to talk about this even further, but I do want to say being a creator actually changed the way I leave comments and feedback on other people's videos, especially larger channels. Yeah. If I see something like, oh, there's a better way, I just keep it to myself because they are getting, you know, dozens. Yeah, they know by now. And so usually in my comments, I'll pick something out that I really like and I'll pinpoint on that. Like that thing right there that you did was super cool. And I find that encouraging and inspiring or whatever. And there's the thing that I help people relate to when it comes to comments, because it's easy to say just ignore the negative comments, but I've said this before, like if you go to a family reunion and 24 people tell you, you look great, you look awesome, it's great seeing you, but then Uncle Joe says, did you gain some weight? When you go to bed that night, you're not going to think of the 24 people that said you look great. You're going to think, why did Uncle Joe say that? It's those, that one thing, that very small thing is the thing that sticks out. So anyway,
yeah.
I'm sorry we had to talk about comments because you're like, I don't want to do it, but it's important. I mean, it's a huge part of our lives.
It is. And I don't want to, you know, we bring it up often on here, and I know people who are not into YouTube or don't do it, it's not interesting for them. But it is part of this whole thing, you know.
It's social media in general, unfortunately.
Well, that's true, yeah. I mean, any representation you put of yourself out there, it's... I'm not saying you're asking for feedback. I don't think we all ask for feedback. In fact, I actively change the way that I wrap up my videos. But yeah, you're subject to it. I mean, it's part of the culture now is to give feedback whether you ask for it or not. But anyway, I think being aware of how your feedback is part of the greater input that a person takes, I think is important. So we'll leave it at that.
You know, I hear my mother's voice every single time. She says, if you're not going to say anything nice, don't say anything at all. So go by Mama Duresta. That's what my mother always says. If you're not going to say anything nice, don't say anything at all.
she's absolutely right.
So we have a topic today.
Do we have a topic?
I think so. We have a subject. How do you guys go about buying tools, either new or used? Is there a process? Are you brand loyal to anything?
I will jump into this because I rely on you two almost exclusively.
That's funny.
For honestly, I don't like to do the research for a tool. Like if I am looking for, like the bandsaw was a good example. I was looking for a second bandsaw, a smaller one, like a benchtop that I could put a thin blade on for small cuts, so I didn't have to switch blades and stuff like that. And I can go look at reviews. I don't believe movie reviews, so I barely believe, you know, tool reviews. It's just like it's all opinion based, right? I would rather somebody I know that's used it, that I know what they do with it. And so I asked you, David, which one you had, because you had two bandsaws for the exact same reason that I had them, so or that I wanted one. And so you said that you had one that you were really happy with, and I immediately ordered it. Same thing for the belt grinder. I asked you which one you were had done all this research about, and you felt confident in that one, and Jimmy had recommended it as well. So that's good enough for me. Like, I'm not, you know, I'm not going to find some better research than what other people that I respect have found. So I do that a lot. I don't think I necessarily have brand loyalty. I think all the DeWalt stuff that I've used in the past has worked well, so I continue to buy it because I already have the batteries. But honestly, I would much rather take a personal recommendation from somebody I know who I like what they do and I trust their experience than care about what brand's on it or what, you know, it's on sale or any of that stuff. That's me.
Yeah.
That's funny.
I never worry too much about price. Go ahead, Dave. You say.
I was just going to say, I'm the opposite. I enjoy the research part of it a little bit, especially on a bigger purchase. Like if you're going to buy something that's like hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars, I kind of enjoy the research. And there's a reason I subscribe to some magazines because they do really good tool shootouts. And you can go through certain magazines when you have a physical subscription, you can go through their back catalog of digital stuff. And so I'm always looking for things that have the best dust collection. Loudness is sometimes a big factor, and longevity and things like that. So I kind of enjoy the research part of it.
And that's why we work so well together, because you can do that work, and then I can just get the tool.
Right.
I am actually, it's funny, I'm thinking this through while we're talking. I typically get a bug for something. I'll be like, I'll see something in a video, or like, for instance, Frank Hallworth was using that big joiner, and everybody knows Frank's famous joiner. And I say, oh, I want one of those. Mm-hmm. That looks good on a video. That's usually how I make decisions.
It looks good on camera.
Looks good on a video. And so I started doing research and looking around. And when I say research, just looking on Craigslist and Googling certain types of things. And then this is like maybe 5 years ago when I finally found that one that I bought. I bought an 18-inch crescent joiner from 1910. And I love it. I love it as an object. I love it as a machine. It's not quite practical, or, you know, it's not a beautiful Powermatic helical head thing that's going to give you the best joint, but it looks great on camera and it sounds great. And that's lately my deciding factor more often than not. But I sometimes get the bug for something. But as far as brand loyalty, I'm really loyal to a certain brand right now because I think I work for them. I don't know if I still do. I'm not going to say who they are yet.
I've seen you got some freshly painted tools, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's because I get comments like, man, they must be treating you well. I'm like, you know what? They don't even return my email, so I don't want them to get that. And I don't even have any. I have absolutely zero connection with the companies that make colored tools at this point. Zero. I don't even get returned emails from them. So I don't.
Same here,
want,
for the record. Yeah.
I don't want companies that have colored tools to live in my videos when fans and commenters think that they're getting the benefit of me. If they want to. Basically, like I said this a while ago, when I paint my tools white, it's basically saying your ad here, which I'm going to start to spray paint on the tools. I'm going to say your ad here. Because people are like, oh, Jimmy's such a rebel. And then when I use a tool that's a color, everyone's like, oh, you sell out. I thought you were a rebel. I'm like, no. I will sell out, but somebody has to come and paste their paste up on my tools. This is rentable space. This is not, I'm a rebel in my own right, but I'm just not giving it away for free. You want it? You got to pay for it. So I'm going to start doing that. I'm going to spray paint a little laser cut that says your ad here. And that's what I'm going to put on my white tools. So that company that has brightly colored tools doesn't even call me back. I don't even know if they pay any attention to the maker market anymore, because there was a moment when they did. I don't think they do anymore. Besides that company, there's another company which there's been some personnel changes, and I can't say just yet who, but I'm having a time researching their competitor because I'm curious to see what I can do with the competition's version of the same tool. I can't say too much to shit, but it's been exciting. So when you talk about research, it's not the type of thing that I usually would do. I would just go boom and get that. But now I'm researching, and I'm, you know, if you could see my YouTube history, you would know exactly who I'm talking about, but I'm not going to tell you. But I've been doing a lot of research on this competitive brand, and it's interesting. And it's interesting, and I might go buy some of their product behind the scenes just so I can be up on it if things switch for me. But, yeah, you know, I've been with a certain brand for a while, and that may or may not change. I don't know. Time will tell if I'm going to stick it through or not. But like I said, there's been some changes, and I just don't have any contact at the moment. I don't know what's going to shake out. But that'll give me the opportunity to use some new versions of something that I really like using. So you might see some changes coming forward. Or you might just see all white ones. Then you'll know that I am a free agent. And I'm just going to put your ad here. But when it comes to bandsaws, I love old bandsaws. I bought a Rycon bandsaw, and I personally hated it. I gave it away. I actually used it as a demonstration at a Filson event. And at the end of the event, I'm like, who wants this? You could just have it. I gave it away.
Nice.
And I hate those 9-inch bandsaws. I've never found one that was powered up enough. They are always underpowered. I stall them constantly. Those 9-inch and 10-inch kind of Amazon style bandsaws, they're just so underpowered. It's like the guys who test them must be cutting styrofoam, because that's the only material that won't stall them, these saws.
See, I have a different experience. Or that,
you just got to cut super, super slow.
Yeah.
I have this big bandsaw now, this big giant one that I got from a fan. I purchased it from a guy in Connecticut. It's a 1928 American Woodworking Tool Company bandsaw, and I can't stop the thing. And that's so refreshing to me.
Yeah, but don't you think that's a little bit something. Of a weird... Don't you think that's a weird comparison? I mean, you have the experience of being able to push your truck through one of your bandsaws and it probably cuts your truck in half. And then you go to like a 9-inch bandsaw. Is there any world where a smaller benchtop tool like that could even... I'm not saying compare to obviously one of your big ones, but like you have the personal experience of
I've had a much more powerful
machine.
Yeah, no, and then it's just something I'm used to. You know, like I have scroll saws. I used to call them jigsaws, but I have scroll saws. And every time I'd say, okay, let me give the scroll saw a chance, I start cutting with it and it's going, blah, 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 and the wood's rattling around, blah, 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 blah. And I'm just like, why didn't I just go to the bandsaw? I'll just cut the thing in half and glue the line shut. You know, I think I'm going to like do like a portrait of Willie Nelson. I'm like, I'll just use the CNC or the laser for that.
It's funny.
So I have like,
I've been thinking about getting a scroll saw.
And I just hate them.
Yeah.
The minute you like you're cutting, it's like your whole entire upper half of your body is like extremely tense, and you're like, and the minute you stop the thing for a minute, it just goes.
I had a scroll saw before, and I gave it to our friend Brian.
I wish
Prusa.
I could make that little video clip as the somehow. I'm sorry, David.
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah, I had a scroll saw, and pretty much that same experience. It's just the whole thing shakes, and you're pushing the piece down so hard. I hated using it, and I'm like, everything that I need to do, I can do on the bandsaw. And so I gave it to our buddy Brian Prusa. But now I'm thinking about getting a scroll saw again, because yes, I would actually prefer to do those tiny little cuts on the CNC, but I think I need a scroll saw just so I can show that it can be done without the CNC, just to allow me to use the bigger tool.
It's funny when it comes to those scroll saws. You go to the shows and you see like the old man clubs where they're making like most beautiful things, and they're all sitting there like concentrating. It looks like there's like 10 old men in a row making those things, and those things come out great. They're beautiful, but it's my experience with scroll saws. I have like 3 of them that I've given away. I bought them brand new and I've given them away because the connection at the top breaks. Because it's like you have to have this clamp that holds the blade. And you know, sometimes it's like this patented flip thing that grabs the blade. Sometimes it's a hex screw, or should I say, what are those wrenches called that have 5 sides?
Allen.
Allen, that's it. Thank you, Allen. It's like an Allen key that gets worn out. Or that it gets over-tightened and something snaps off. So I had like 3 brand new ones in the last 20 years that I just literally gave to somebody. I'm like, you know what? I don't have the time to get on the phone with this company and replace this part. You could have this. Mm. It's brand new $300 machine. You could have it. Take it. And now I have another one that my dad bought for like $1,000. My dad bought it a few years ago. I don't know what the brand is. But it has this leather belt. And it's supposed to be a rubber belt. But the rubber belt, you can't change it without taking the whole entire side of the machine apart. And I was just going to make a leather belt and glue it in there. And I just haven't needed it, but I have to replace the belt when I get into it. But when I look at a scroll saw, I just say, you know what? A laser would replace that. But I guess there's no fun in just lasering it up for those guys that are retired that want to make Willie Nelson's face.
Well, I've not ever used this, but I've always assumed the spiral bits for a scroll saw would help with that because they cut on the way up and on the way down. Is that correct or is that wrong?
I think they only cut on the way down.
It's just you can cut any
they cut in every direction.
Oh, you can cut it at any angle. Yeah. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
Because I think that's the problem with the scroll saw, right, is that it's cutting on the way down, but then it's like the blade is lifting the piece with it when it goes up, and that's why it's bouncing around. There's got to be a way around that.
There's a little thing that puts pressure down.
Big, giant, like, mouse trap that holds it down.
That thing just, that's in the way. That doesn't actually help anything.
Yeah.
That's why you think it's cool, and you, like, pick it up and you turn it backwards, and then you free-blading it, and then all of a sudden you're like, untense your shoulders for 1 second, the thing just goes ape nuts. It's just going
to... I think, Bob, you're on to something. I think it's one of those tools that could be improved on, where it's something that it automatically puts the right amount of pressure on there and adjust on the fly. So, yeah. It's like drill press tables should come with an electronic lift.
I agree.
Yes.
Well, I got a scroll saw from just a guy I knew. His dad was getting rid of it. And so I like picked it up because I didn't think I would really need it. But I was like, it's like $50. It's a thing that I could, you know, try to work in. And I rarely use it. And I've thought about getting rid of it a few times. But then on occasion, there's like some little reason why it would make sense to use it. And we're doing something. Oh, yeah. I was working on this one project and I made this little piece right here. And, you know, I had to cut a rectangle out of the inside of a piece of wood. And I had already cut it down to size, so I couldn't use the bandsaw. I would lose some of the width of the material. And, you know, in that case, it was really easy to drill a hole and then use the scroll saw to cut out that rectangle in the middle of a piece. And then it'll go back under the bench for another 6 months. Before
So I have a question. Do you ever buy the cheapest tool that you can? I recently bought a super cheap tool based on a podcast, our podcast, maybe last week or the week before. I got that sewing machine for $100 and some. And I'm like, I'm not going to use a sewing machine for leather very much, maybe once a year. So I need something that's super cheap. And that was a recent purchase. How about you guys?
I mean, I bought that same one, but I bought it not because it was cheap, but because I saw Chris Zepp use it.
Successfully,
and I saw him take three pieces of thick leather and run it through there by hand, you know, like hand cranked, go through there with no effort. And I'm like, well, I mean, I saw him do that. So I know that that thing should work like what I just saw, you know. I mean, the fact that it was pretty inexpensive was nice, but that I would have skipped over a cheaper version of that same tool for the one that I saw somebody use personally.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got for that same tool. I've always wanted. I really want. I was so excited to get. And I guess it's okay to talk about this because I'm not really getting paid. I don't have a contract with them, but I always wanted the Boss, which is the machine that has the leather on top. You go chunk, chunk. You pull a lever and it goes through thick saddle leather. You pull the lever and it goes through leather, and I've seen them at knife shows, where there's always a guy making a knife sheath. And then I got to be friends with the guys at the Tandy Leather Company. And I said, when I met them, and they're like, oh my God, what do you want? We'll give you whatever you need. I was like, you know what? I've always wanted a Boss. He goes, well, they're discontinued, but we have old stock. And when I mentioned to Taylor I was going to get a Boss, I actually always wanted to buy one. She wouldn't let me buy one. She's like, they are always a problem. She said, do not spend money on it. She goes, there's better machines for a little bit more money that are foolproof, because there's always a problem. So Tandy sent me a Boss. It's like a $1,500 machine. It never worked out of the box. I never got it to make one stitch. Huh. I gave up on it, and I never did a video. I talked about getting it and being excited to use it, and I never used it because it never, ever, ever worked. And to the point where, like, I feel like I'm breaking it. I'm like cranking. It's not making a complete stitch. And I gave it to Derek from Malden, my buddy Derek, took it, and he actually called the company, and he got there was certain parts that just weren't right, and they knew right away. They're like, oh, this is always a problem. Take this part and do it. And so Derek fixed it for me, and I haven't had a chance to get it back, but he says it works great now. But the difficulty of going through that, I mean, I could only imagine if I spent the money on it, how frustrated I'd be.
Oh, yeah.
Because Taylor warned me. She's like, that has a notorious reputation for never working correctly. And I've seen guys at shows using it. I was at a couple of different knife shows, and guys, and it's working beautifully. And I said to him, I go, does this have a problem? I said, it's got a bad reputation. He goes, no, if you just like do this and this, and it works fine. And anyway, when I got it, I was just completely amazed at how accurate the bad reputation was for that tool. And again, they don't make it anymore. But then that's why Chris was highlighting that sewing machine to me. He knew the problems behind the scenes I had with the Boss machine. It's called the Tippmann Boss. That's the leather machine that didn't work. And so that thing for like 100 and change, which is a fraction of the cost of the Tippmann Boss. And Chris said it works foolproof nearly every time. He made some adjustments to it, but it works. And you guys both have it, so.
But I haven't used it yet.
Yeah.
I'll get my Tippmann back from Derek in time. But Derek says it's been working great. So, but now Taylor and I are looking at a very high end. Well, high end. It's probably about $3,000 machine to sew leather. So it's like it's that same machine you guys are talking about, but it's you step on a treadle and in the motor and everything, and it's got high torque, high strength, and it'll go through like an inch thick worth of hide. So you could put like four layers of, you know, like 10-ounce leather on there. It'll sew all of them together and compensate for the length of the stitch and everything. Hmm. So it's a really highly industrial machine. So Taylor's been doing all the research. So we might just get one of those and just like take it on a payment plan or something with the company. They're not too receptive to any kind of like influence in marketing. These companies are like, they're so industrial, they don't even care like about the real world. They're like in this secret world, like deep in a cave where they just make things for factories and they could care less who has their machine or not. It's almost like robots run the company. It's really funny. Mm. Tell Josh I saw him sneak in.
Josh, you're an hour late. I hate putting tools together. I'm so lucky and fortunate to have Dan around, because when the belt grinder showed up, I'm like, here you go, Dan, put that together. The sewing machine showed up. I'm like, Dan, next week you're putting that together.
I hate putting tools together. I can't stand it. That's like that's why I think we might have talked about this. I'm thinking about a new plasma machine. I don't know who I talked about, but my friend's got one and he's thinking about selling it. Plasma table. It would take a truck and a forklift to move it because it's a big one. But I would prefer to buy his used one than buy a brand new one, because the brand new one comes in parts.
Right.
His is already put together, and I'd rather buy his new. I mean, I'd rather buy his used than have to put one together. I just can't stand that part of the process.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of it either. I think we've talked about this before, but you know, 3D printers often come as kits, and there's a lot of people that really enjoy making their 3D printer from a kit or even from scratch. And I've done that. That my first one was a kit, and I've done another Prusa as a kit as well. And it's not hard. It's not, you know, it's not a difficult thing to do. It just takes time. But when I get a tool, I want to use the tool. I don't want a project that happens to end up as a tool. Mm-hmm. And so for me, putting together a 3D printer just means that I'm going to have to then spend a huge amount of time getting it working like it's supposed to work, versus spending a little bit more money to have it pre-assembled and tested and, you know, pretty much ready to go out of the box. And so, I mean, that's a little different than just assembling something like a belt grinder where you just have a couple of parts you have to put on. But yeah, I'm not a fan of having to
and another tools either. The packaging. If I get a new bigger tool, there's so much packaging, so much styrofoam or crates or plywood or whatever. Like, it takes up the entire that week's trash. And so then it sets my home trash back a week. Like, I don't know what to do with all this stuff.
Yeah. So we have a lot of packages come in here. Like, a lot. And we have a lot of recycling, because I do my best to recycle as much as we possibly can of everything. And, we have a family of six, and then we also have this business in the basement that gets a lot of packages. And a couple weeks ago, so they give you the little recycling bin, little green bin, you know, which we fill up in like a day and a half in our house. And so I got a big garbage can, and I spray painted the recycling symbol and the company's logo on the side of it.
Oh, wow.
So that... Because I called them and they were like, we don't have big ones. Just get your own can, put the logo on it. We'll pick it up. So did this. So every week we have this full, 50-gallon trash can, plus the little thing, plus usually a stack of cardboard boxes next to it. A couple weeks ago, I don't know why I'm telling you this because this is not interesting at all, but a couple weeks ago, they just didn't take our recycling. We had a full can, big can, and they just didn't take it. And then I got a roof rack for my Land Cruiser, which came in a big box that was about like 6 feet by 5 feet or something like that. Plus we got the belt grinder. Plus we got some other tool, a pressure pot, and all this other stuff. And I had a pile of recycling that was probably, I don't know, 6 feet by 6 feet on the ground and probably 4 feet tall. It was gigantic. Oh, man. And that's recycling. Then we had the trash and all the other build materials that we have to throw away, stuff that we can't reuse or can't recycle. Anyway, I feel your pain because we just have a huge amount of packaging all the time that I wish we could not have.
Our local grocery store, it's a Kroger. They have a recycling area. So they have like 6-7 bins for cardboard, and they got a bin for cans and paper. And so whenever our recycling overflows, I just load up the Jeep and take it there. But it's so sad because people take advantage of it. And there's no trash. It's all recycling bins. And I'll see like a couch. I'll see bags of trash just sitting outside. And it's like, you are going to ruin it for the rest of us. I have this nice, convenient place to take my recycling. And then there's people dumping their furniture there. It's
My landlord recycles all cardboard because he has a shipping and receiving company. So he says any cardboard, just bring over to me. And they bail it. And then they have a company comes and picks it up. So that's useful for us as well. He said, bring whatever you need over anytime. So that's what we do.
And listeners, that is called a tangent.
Yep. Big, long, unimportant tangent. All right.
But I wanted to say something. I wanted to say one thing about, hold on, I'm going to mute and call. Thank you. I wanted to say something about old tools. Everyone knows I like to buy and recycle old tools I hate setting up new things, but I love bringing old things back to life. I like when I get an old bandsaw and I free up the bearings and I put, maybe put new rubber on them or get the right motor on them. I love doing that because that feels like there's something spiritually exciting about that. You feel like you're bringing something back to life. And I mean, that's the appeal across the board, I think, for recycling or rehabbing old tools. You know, like we got Eric's channel, which Hand Tool Rescue, and then all the channels like his that all do very well doing tool restorations. But I don't do too many videos about tool restorations. I could probably do a lot more. I spend a lot more time behind the scenes restoring devices and tools and hand tools. But there is something nice about that. That's an exciting tool hunt for me, is looking for something vintage and trying to find one that's within striking range, driving distance, and something that's in usable shape for a reasonable price. And to me, that's exciting. And it always has to have a nice texture on it, something that's really nice. So like, for instance, yesterday I went to the flea market and I bought this old vise. I didn't do any stories on it or anything. But I said to the guy, do you have any more tools like this? And he goes, oh, yeah. He goes, this is like a fits all podcast conversation. But he says, I have a vise that's about 300 pounds. I go, you have a 300-pound vise? I said, how much you want for it? I said, $250. I said, can I pay you for it now? He goes, wait till you see it. Wait till you see it. Just relax. Wait till you see it. I was like, no, I want it. He goes, it's not going anywhere.
I want it now.
He goes, it's not going anywhere. And he lives like an hour from here. He was at the flea market with a truck full of stuff. But I'm going to contact that guy today. But that's exciting because I need a 250 or 300-pound vise. I definitely need that. That's something I need.
You do? You know?
Yeah, absolutely need it.
For what?
I don't know why. I don't know yet.
Okay.
No, you know why I need it? And this is how I rationalize buying everything that I don't need. It'll look good in a video.
You can't see the weight of something on video.
No, like if I put like a quarter in like a 300-pound vise and you see that I could put 10 quarters across, but I'm only putting one, like to get out my file to like file out the face. That's the kind of like
you should
contrast.
Use that vise to put in a pocket hole. Just like mount the piece in a big 300-pound vise and then put in a pocket.
So so that's for me, that's in the future. But I like the excitement of hunting old tools, and that's something I probably don't need to say. Everybody knows that. But that's where like the idea of assembling, dismantling, putting something back together, looking at the way it was made, how the different parts were assembled, and that's for me, that's a learning process where putting together something brand new is just inconvenient because the whole time I'm like, oh, they could have done this better. Oh, they should have used the better screw. Oh, they shouldn't have used stamped metal. Oh, this is plastic. Really? Really? This is plastic? So that's the conversation I'm having when I'm putting together something new in my head. Really? Plastic? Really?
Really?
How much was this? Really?
It's funny. I have a big Rikon planer. And a friend of mine he was looking at getting that particular model. He's like, can I come over and look at yours? And I'm like, yeah, sure. It works great. And he's like, yeah, I want to see if the gears are metal. I'm like, yeah, I'm sure they're metal. And he opens it up and the gears are actually plastic in there. And I was like,
really? Plastic? Really? Really? Really?
And he's not going to buy one based on that. But
huh.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, we should probably wrap this up. We're an hour in. Let me thank our Patreon supporters while you guys figure out what you're going to recommend. Big thanks to everybody that helped us out on Patreon. We are grateful for it because we don't have sponsors. We've never had sponsors. We don't want sponsors on this show because we have awesome patrons who help us pay for the cost of doing this and pay for our time, and that's awesome. So thank you guys. Big thanks to our top supporters, Corey Ward, Works by Solo, Chad from Mancrafting, Maker in Training, Funkiss Artistic Creations, Blondie Hacks, You Can Make This Too, Modern DIY, Jenny and Davis, and Make Build Modify. Everybody who supports us at any level gets the after show, which is usually some secret stuff, other stuff. I'm going to talk about something new for me today.
All right.
Yeah, it's been a secret for a while. It's not going to be a secret much longer, but we're still going to talk about it today. So we will do that. And if you want to hear that, go to patreon.com/makingit and help us out. And if you don't, that's cool too. Sharing the show around with people that you know that might like it would be awesome. Leaving a review on iTunes apparently lets other people know that this show exists. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what everybody says. So that would be cool. But either way, thanks to the support for the support from everybody over on Patreon.
Thank you.
All right, David, what do you have?
Brad Rodriguez put out a video yesterday on making a steel fire pit, and it's super awesome looking. It's a great, quick video. Well done. Everything about it is just fantastic. I want this fire pit.
I haven't watched the video yet, but I saw on his Instagram about him making it, and I'm like, that's a really clever, simple design. Mm-hmm. I mean, it looks great.
It looks really good. Yeah, it's hot.
Cool.
Yeah, you see what I did
there. It's a fire pit. Yeah, I got it. What you got, Jimmy?
I've been watching this channel. I had to dig through my history to find the name of the actual channel. It's called LA Machines. It popped up, and I've been watching a lot of videos there, and it shows industrial processes of how metal is bent, rolled, different how rope is made. It's one of those how-to channels, but it's like somebody who has either access to these video clips or access to these factories. I can't quite tell because a lot of the videos seem somewhat generic, but you get to see how certain factory processes are done. And for me, that helps me because I can reverse engineer a process by seeing how it's done here. And then in my mind, I'm like, oh, I could use that over here. So for me, like when I watch a channel like this over and over, just kind of mindlessly, it's like reading the dictionary for me. I start to catalog the way things are done, how things are made, and then I start to figure out if it's in my brain, then while I'm working, I'm like, oh my God, there's that process. I could use that right here. You know what I'm saying? It's like input, 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 and then I have a very interesting way to solve this problem down the road. So LA Machines, there's lots of these channels. This just happens to be one that popped up, and I've been watching a lot. It's got really decent content.
Cool. So mine is a video that I got, well, at Maker Faire, when we were all hanging out, somebody came up to me and started talking to me, a guy named Kurt. Hey, Kurt, if you're listening. And he started telling me about this computer-controlled loom that he was working on. And it sounded really cool. And he said he'd been working on it for over a year, and he was making a video, but he didn't know if he would put it out, and he didn't know when he'd be finished with it, and this and that. And it sounded really awesome. And so I encouraged him to make sure that he finished it and put out the video because I wanted to see it. He was just telling me about it. He put out this video, and it's really awesome. I mean, the video is good. Like, it's funny. He's got some, like, comedy in it. He's in it. But it's also really good because it shows kind of the process and how much work went into – well, probably not how much work, but a lot of the work that went into this thing that took him a year to do. And the machine itself is amazing. Like, it's – far more complicated than I would have had the patience to do. And it's just really cool. And it's the only video that he has on his channel, I believe. And I want him and people like him to be encouraged to continue to do the projects that they're working on, even though they take a long time. Because, I mean, this is a thing that a computer-controlled loom is something I had thought briefly about a couple of years ago. I'm like, well, you know, we can do CNCs. It's like similar process, but there's like different mechanics that have to be handled, but I'm sure it's possible. But then when I started looking into it, I was just like, man, this would be a huge amount of work. So I left it behind, and he didn't. He did it. He finished it and got it working, and it's awesome. And so I want people to see that and want him to be encouraged to continue to share his builds, because I think it's cool. So
what's the name of his channel?
Go check it out. His channel's called Retro Tech Journal.
I see it. All right.
And I think that's the only video. Yeah. And he's got 400 subscribers, but, you know, it's a cool video. So go check it out. You guys got anything else?
That's it. Secret stuff now.
Secret stuff. Cool. Well, I guess that's it for this week. Then, yeah. Thanks for listening. Oh, man, the drip's back. You have a leak,
Jimmy. A little leak. I thought I fixed that. Just right on my head. Did you see it splash on the computer?
Yeah, I saw it. It's like, yeah, splash on the computer.
If I have the slightest bit of a smile, if I have the slightest smile, I can't do it. The drip stops.
Make them laugh.
All right, see you guys next time.
Bye. Love you.